Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, narrated by Charlton Heston. This is tape number one on John Dewey.
Old ideas give way slowly, for they are more than abstract logical forms and categories. They are habits, predispositions, deeply ingrained attitudes of aversion and preference. Moreover, the conviction persists, though history shows it to be a hallucination, that all the questions that the human mind has asked are questions that can be answered in terms of the alternatives that the questions themselves present. But, in fact, intellectual progress usually occurs through sheer abandonment of questions, together with both of the alternatives they assume. An abandonment that results from their decreasing vitality and a change of urgent interest. We do not solve them. We get over them.
This central and revolutionary insight pervades the work of the great American pragmatist, John Dewey. Philosophy mustn't strive to provide new, better answers to old questions. Rather, it must address new questions, important issues raised by far-reaching recent developments and changes in human life. On the whole, Dewey thinks that philosopher after philosopher has failed to give up traditional but now trivial concerns and old-fashioned but now outdated methods.
Intellectual advance occurs in two ways. At times, increase of knowledge is organized about old conceptions, while they are expanded, elaborated, and refined, but not seriously revised, much less abandoned. At other times, the increase of knowledge demands qualitative rather than quantitative change, alteration, not addition. Men's minds grow cold to their former intellectual concerns. Ideas that were burning fade. Interests that were urgent seem remote. Men face in another direction. Their older perplexities are unreal. Considerations passed over as negligible loom up. Former problems may not have been solved, but they no longer press for solution. Philosophy is no exception to this rule, but it is unusually conservative, not necessarily in proffering solutions, but in clinging to problems.
Dewey says that 19th and 20th century philosophy is too conservative. It's failed to come to grips with new problems, new realities. Of course, traditional philosophers disagree about the proper answers to philosophical questions, but a more significant fact is often obscured. Traditional philosophers largely agree about the proper questions in philosophy. Of course, traditional philosophers include Platonists, Aristotelians, Cartesians, Kantians, Hegelians, or Nietzscheans. They might be mystics, materialists, idealists, empiricists, skeptics, or nihilists. They all focus on their differences from one another, but from a wider perspective, these differences are relatively small, superficial, mostly intramural. Dewey believes traditional philosophers have pursued tedious, theoretical issues unconnected to recent developments in social life and science. He says that traditional philosophic inquiry increasingly has little practical value. The very idea that this philosophy might be pragmatic seems fanciful, if not self-contradictory. Dewey admonishes these philosophers and demands change.
The sort of thing the philosophers of an earlier period did is now done. In substance, it is no longer called for. Persistence in repetition of a work that has little or no significance in the life conditions that now exist is as sure a way as could be found for promoting the remoteness of philosophy by reducing it to a kind of highly professionalized busy work.
Dewey's point isn't that early philosophy is false. Rather, he says new developments have rendered it useless, inert, insignificant.
The displacing of this wholesale type of philosophy will doubtless not arrive by sheer logical disproof, but rather by growing recognition of its futility.
By radically reconstructing philosophy, Dewey wants to root it in actual experience rather than speculative theory, academic puzzles. He hopes to achieve nothing less than a full recovery of philosophy itself.
Philosophy is vision, imagination, reflection. and these functions, apart from action, modify nothing and hence resolve nothing. Until it frees itself from identification with problems which are supposed to depend upon reality as such, or its distinction from a world of appearance, or its relation to a knower as such, the hands of philosophy are tied. Philosophy recovers itself when it ceases to be a device for dealing with the problems of philosophers and becomes a method cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems of men.
Philosophy must begin with these actual changing problems of men and women. It must aim to solve them through imagination, reflection, experiment, and action. When it fails to confront practical problems in this way, philosophy may become remote, useless, merely technical. But Dewey's ultimate concern is not the consequences for philosophy itself. He's concerned with the consequences for our society.
The chief intellectual characteristic of the present age is its despair of any constructive philosophy, not just in its technical meaning, but in the sense of any integrated outlook and attitude. The developments of the last century have gone so far that we are now aware of the shock and overturn in older beliefs. But the formation of a new, coherent view of nature and man based upon facts consonant with science and actual social conditions is still to be had. What we call the Victorian Age seemed to have such a philosophy. It was a philosophy of hope, of progress, of all that is called liberalism. The growing sense of unsolved social problems has shaken that faith. It is impossible to recover its mood. The result is disillusionment about all comprehensive and positive ideas. The possession of constructive ideals is taken to be an admission that one is living in a realm of fantasy. Because the hopes and expectations of the past have been discredited, there is cynicism as to all far-reaching plans and policies.
But Dewey doesn't share this cynicism.
The very knowledge which enables us to detect the illusory character of past hopes and aspirations, a knowledge denied those who held them, may enable us to form purposes and expectations that are better grounded. A philosophic faith, being a tendency to action, can be tried and tested only in action. I know of no viable alternative in the present day to such a philosophy.
The need for a new philosophy, a reconstructed philosophy, results directly from recent and far-reaching cultural changes. They were produced by new knowledge, particularly in the natural sciences, new technology, new political and economic realities, new social arrangements and relations, new views of nature and human nature. Now these changes are the starting point for a new practical philosophy. Dewey was born in Burlington, Vermont in 1859. He witnessed many cultural changes firsthand in his own remarkably active and long life. His 92 years spanned the American Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the Boer War in South Africa, the Boxer Uprising in China, the Russian Revolution, World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II, and the horrors of Auschwitz. Darwin's Origin of Species was published the same year Dewey was born, 1859. And Dewey lived during the development of Marx's communism, Freud's psychoanalysis, and Einstein's relativity theory. The electric light, telephone, television, automobile, airplane, the atom bomb were developed during his life. Although philosophers traditionally have emphasized and glorified the eternal and the stable, Dewey focuses on the temporal and the precarious.
Social change is here as a fact. Transformations in the family, the church, the school, in science and art, in economic and political relations are occurring so swiftly that imagination is baffled in attempt to lay hold of them.
Cultural changes are not only more widespread, also more rapid than at any time in our past. Dewey says the Industrial Revolution marked the beginning of a continuing series of great material transformations.
The fact of change has been so continual and so intense that it overwhelms our minds. We are bewildered by the spectacle of its rapidity, scope, and intensity.
Wholesale changes have altered the external conditions of our lives, but no similar changes have altered our beliefs, our values, shared meanings. Dewey says these changes caught us unprepared. We still cling to outdated beliefs that no longer fit our circumstances. Our practices contradict our theories.
Because of this lack of mental and moral preparation, the impact of swiftly moving changes produced confusion, uncertainty, and drift. Industrial habits have changed most rapidly. There has followed, at considerable distance, change in political relations. Alterations in legal relations and methods have lagged even more, while changes in the institutions that deal most directly with patterns of thought and belief have taken place to the least extent.
Noting this gap between theory and practice, Dewey calls the United States of America, as Lincoln did, a house divided against itself.
It is becoming a commonplace to say that in thought and feeling, or at least in the language in which they are expressed, we are living in some bygone century, anywhere from the 13th to the 18th, although physically and externally we belong to the 20th century. What is the cause of this split and contradiction? There are those, of course, who attribute it to the fact that people being, generally speaking, morons and boobs, they must be expected to act out the parts to which they are assigned. The explanation does not take us very far, even if one accepts it. The particular forms that the alleged boobery takes are left quite unaccounted for, and the more one knows of history, the more one comes to believe that traditions and institutions count more than native capacity or incapacity in explaining things. It is evident enough that the rapid industrialization of our civilization took us unawares. Being mentally and morally unprepared, our older creeds have become ingrowing. The more we depart from them in fact, the more loudly we proclaim them, to prevent ourselves from seeing them.
Dewey's contemporary, the philosopher, poet, and novelist George Santayana, also diagnoses a gap.
America is a young country with an old mentality. It is a country with two mentalities. One, a survival of the beliefs and standards of the fathers. The other, an expression of the instincts, practice, and discoveries of the younger generations. In all things of the mind, in religion, in literature, in the moral emotions, it is the hereditary spirit that still prevails. So much so that Mr. Bernard Shaw finds that America is 100 years behind the times. The truth is that one half of the American mind, that not occupied intensely in practical affairs, has remained, I will not say high and dry, but slightly becalmed. It has floated gently in the backwater, while alongside, in invention and industry and social organization, the other half of the mind was leaping down a sort of Niagara Rapids. This division may be found symbolized in American architecture, a neat reproduction of the colonial mansion, with some modern comforts introduced surreptitiously, stands beside the skyscraper. The American will inhabits the skyscraper. The American intellect inhabits the colonial mansion.
Dewey says philosophy has to overcome this split. It must help us develop values, beliefs, and commitments that improve our lives. Dewey's writings, the equivalent of more than 35 volumes written over a period of 70 years, constitute a sustained effort to achieve this reconstruction. Dewey created a new account of human experience, a new epistemology and logic of human inquiry, a new philosophy of education, a new social and political philosophy, and new theories of ethics, art, and religion. It's little wonder that the great philosopher and mathematician Alfred North Whitehead proclaimed the 20th century to be the age of Dewey.
John Dewey is to be classed among those men who have made philosophic thought relevant to the needs of their own day. He has disclosed great ideas relevant to the functioning of the social system. The magnitude of this achievement is to be estimated by reference to the future. For many generations, the North American continent will be the living center of human civilization. Thought and action will derive from it and refer to it. We are living in the midst of the period subject to Dewey's influence. He is the chief intellectual force providing that environment with coherent purpose.
Whitehead was right. Dewey's reconstruction of philosophy aims to reconstruct our environment, even our lives. The point of philosophy, Dewey reminds us, is not to make theory practical. The point is to make practice intelligent. The scope and extent of John Dewey's work is staggering, but it also can be confusing. Dewey wanted to overturn old philosophical habits and standard arguments with new ideas. He believed the standard syntax didn't fit his needs, so his writing style is difficult. It's sometimes slow-going. One of his main concerns was that philosophy should become, again, an active tool that helps us live better, more fulfilling lives. He wanted to integrate theory and practice, to contribute to the real world around him as well as writing scholarly books. So he became actively involved in social organizations and causes. During his stay at the University of Chicago from 1894 to 1904, he founded a world-famous elementary school known as the Laboratory School, more popularly called the Dewey School. He also worked with the Chicago public school system. He helped Jane Addams, the well-known social reformer at Hull House, a settlement house concerned with urban problems facing America's immigrants. In 1904, Dewey moved to Columbia University in New York. From there, his writings, lectures, and travels spurred educational changes in many foreign countries, including Japan, China, Turkey, Mexico, and the USSR. To promote freedom of inquiry, Dewey founded the American Association of University Professors. He also helped create the Teachers Union movement in New York. Through the years, Dewey also wrote voluminously on public affairs and issues of the day for popular magazines like the New Republic. In fact, this work continued past supposed retirements and farewell celebrations in 1929, 1939, and 1949. While Dewey's work clearly expresses his concerns, his commitments, he wrote remarkably little about himself. In a brief autobiographical essay, From Absolutism to Experimentalism, Dewey does reveal sources of the development of his work, sources essential for understanding it. He explains his early attraction to the idealistic philosophy of Hegel.
Hegel's thought supplied a demand for unification that was doubtless an intense emotional craving, and yet was a hunger that only an intellectualized subject matter could satisfy. It is more than difficult, it is impossible, to recover that early mood. But the sense of divisions and separations that were, I suppose, born in upon me as a consequence of a heritage of New England culture, divisions by way of isolation of self from the world, of soul from body, of nature from God, brought a painful oppression, or rather, they were an inward laceration. My earlier philosophic study had been an intellectual gymnastic. Hegel's synthesis of subject and object, matter and spirit, the divine and the human, was, however, no mere intellectual formula. It operated as an immense release, a liberation. Hegel's treatment of human culture, of institutions and the arts, involved the same dissolution of hard and fast dividing walls, and had a special attraction for me.
Dewey later abandoned Hegelian idealism for a more naturalistic view of existence, a more pragmatic account of logic and inquiry. but he noted the enduring significance of his own early thought.
Acquaintance with Hegel has left a permanent deposit in my thinking. The rest of the story of my intellectual development I am unable to record without more faking than I care to indulge in. The philosopher that I became as I moved away from German idealism is too much the self that I still am, and is still too much in process of change to lend itself to record. I envy, up to a certain point, those who can write their intellectual biography in a unified pattern, woven out of a few distinctly discernible strands of interest and influence. By contrast, I seem to be unstable, chameleon-like, yielding one after another to many diverse and even incompatible influences, struggling to assimilate something from each, and yet striving to carry it forward in a way that is logically consistent with what has been learned from its predecessors. Upon the whole, the forces that have influenced me have come from persons and from situations more than from books. Not that I have not, I hope, learned a great deal from philosophical writings, but that what I have learned from them has been technical in comparison with what I have been forced to think upon and about because of some experience in which I found myself entangled.
Though Dewey learned mostly from experience, one particular writer, the American philosopher and psychologist William James, influenced him immensely. James convinced Dewey to treat consciousness pragmatically and scientifically as an active, objective human trait.
It was reserved for James to think of life in terms of life in action. Jamesian psychology led straight to the perception of the importance of distinctive social categories, especially communication and participation. It is my conviction that a great deal of our philosophizing needs to be done over again from this point of view, and that there will ultimately result an integrated synthesis in a philosophy congruous with modern science and related to actual needs in education, morals, and religion.
James and Dewey insist that the value and truth of a theory depend on its results rather than its source. This is the whole of his pragmatism in embryo. The continuing pragmatic reconstruction of philosophy requires imagination and inquiry.
I think it shows a deplorable deadness of imagination to suppose that philosophy will indefinitely revolve within the scope of the problems and systems that 2,000 years of European history have bequeathed to us. Seen in the long perspective of the future, the whole of Western European history is a provincial episode. Meantime, a chief task of those who call themselves philosophers is to help get rid of the useless lumber that blocks our highways of thought, and strive to make straight and open the paths that lead to the future.
At the heart of Dewey's reconstruction of philosophy is his new view of human experience. This sweeping vision underlies and informs his extensive work in logic, education, ethics, politics, aesthetics, and religion. To understand his theory of experience, it's necessary first to grasp his view of the aims and nature of philosophy itself. What is philosophy? What's its subject matter, its method, its results? What are its objectives? How are philosophic theories and disagreements evaluated? These aren't new questions, of course, but Dewey's responses are strikingly refreshing. He stresses first that philosophy is a human activity. It's something we do and undergo, just as we drive a car, talk with friends, fall in love, or stay up all night with a sick child. But philosophy is also a reflective, a purposeful activity. It responds to life's problems and seeks to solve them. This means that a philosophy is situated in experience. Experience supplies the problems of philosophy.
The distinctive office, problems, and subject matter of philosophy grow out of stresses and strains in the community life in which a given form of philosophy arises.
Dewey insists that philosophical problems are rooted in everyday experiences, despite contrary, self-deceived pronouncements by other philosophers.
The task of future philosophy is to clarify men's ideas as to the social and moral strifes of their own day. Its aim is to become, so far as is humanly possible, an organ for dealing with these conflicts. Instead of the disputes of rivals about the nature of reality, we have the scene of human clash of social purpose and aspirations. Instead of impossible attempts to transcend experience, we have the significant record of the efforts of men to formulate the things of experience to which they are most deeply and passionately attached. Instead of impersonal and purely speculative endeavors to contemplate, as remote beholders, the nature of absolute things in themselves, we have a living picture of the choice of thoughtful men about what they would have life to be, and to what ends they would have men shape their intelligent activities.
According to William James, American pragmatism was founded in the 19th century by the logician Charles Peirce. Peirce cautioned that we mustn't pretend to doubt in philosophy what we don't doubt in our hearts. Dewey adds that any philosophy unconnected to ordinary experience wastes our time on artificial problems. Our experience is always in flux, so we can't possibly define philosophy's problems in advance. In the end, experience alone provides the measure of philosophy's success or failure.
Thus, there is here supplied, I think, a first-rate test of the value of any philosophy which is offered us. Does it end in conclusions which, when they are referred back to ordinary life experiences and their predicaments, render them more significant, more luminous to us, and make our dealing with them more fruitful? Or does it terminate in rendering the things of ordinary experience more opaque than they were before, and in depriving them of having in reality even the significance they had previously seemed to have? It is the fact that so many philosophies terminate in conclusions that make it necessary to disparage and condemn primary experience, which leads cultivated common sense to look askance at philosophy.
Philosophies, like all other empirical investigations, from biology to economics, from physics to sociology, it can't begin in total doubt. It can't be wholly free of presuppositions. Dewey says philosophy can't provide certainty. Its truths aren't perfect, final, or eternal. Philosophy can't characterize or reveal any supposedly ultimate reality, transcendent being, or supernatural dimension. Finally, it can't be disinterested contemplation, pure reason, or a passive reflection of an independent reality. If philosophy is to develop an effective system of operative ideas, then it has to develop a method that's pragmatic and empirical. Philosophy has to become primarily a method rather than a system. We should think of philosophy as intelligent methods of inquiry rather than an overarching system of beliefs. William James, in his landmark lectures on pragmatism, also described philosophy as a method.
Pragmatism does not stand for any special results. It is a method only. But the general triumph of that method would mean an enormous change. If you follow the pragmatic method, you must bring out of each word its practical cash value. Set it at work within the stream of your experience. It appears less as a solution then than as a program for more work, and more particularly as an indication of the ways in which existing realities may be changed. Theories thus become instruments, not answers to enigmas in which we can rest.
Philosophical issues must be framed in terms drawn from actual experience. Conclusions must be stated in terms of experience, and they must be verified or falsified in experience. Using the empirical method in philosophy provides no positive guarantees. Still, it means we can improve on the interminable disagreements and pseudo-problems of non-empirical philosophy. Dewey says we can see the benefits of the empirical method in the great successes of the natural and social sciences. He contends they stand in sharp contrast to the lack of advance in philosophy. Progress in philosophy awaits a similar adoption of the empirical method.
The empirical method places before others a map of the road that has been traveled. They may accordingly, if they will, retravel the road to inspect the landscape for themselves. The adoption of empirical method thus procures for philosophic reflection something of that cooperative tendency toward consensus which marks inquiry in the natural sciences.
The value of the empirical method is practical. It lets us predict consequences and reach our goals. So in Dewey's concept, philosophy doesn't simply develop intelligent methods of inquiry, it also actively reconstructs democratic society. Here the tasks confronting philosophy and those confronting American society merge.
Democracy is belief in the ability of human experience to generate the aims and methods by which further experience will grow in ordered richness. Every other form of moral and social faith rests upon the idea that experience must be subjected at some point or other to some form of external control, to some authority alleged to exist outside the process of experience. Democracy is faith that the process of experience is more important than any special result attained, so that special results achieved are of ultimate value only as they are used to enrich and order the ongoing process. Since the process of experience is capable of being educative, faith in democracy is all one with faith in experience and education.
Dewey's sophisticated theory of experience stands at the center of his philosophy. It's based on his experimental method of philosophic inquiry. It also stands in sharp contrast to the views of earlier so-called empiricist philosophers such as Aristotle, John Locke, David Hume, and John Stuart Mill. Dewey says that experience includes more than thinking and knowing. Experience isn't subjective, inaccessibly private, or merely mental. It includes broader categories of action. Experience doesn't focus exclusively or primarily on the past. It includes today's projects. It looks forward. Experience isn't composed of discrete, distinct sense data that await assembly by the mind. Instead, it's shot through with thought, inference, inquiry. Dewey believed that earlier empiricists based their views on traditional prejudices and assumptions, unsupported by experience. Splits and dualisms have pervaded traditional philosophy, separating theory from practice, knowledge from action, subject from object. Other dichotomies separate the mind from the body, the self from society, experience from nature, and values from fact. So Dewey says that so-called empirical philosophy has not been very empirical.
Traditional accounts have not been empirical, but have been deductions from unnamed premises of what experience must be. Historic empiricism has been empirical in a technical and controversial sense. It has said, Lord, Lord, experience, experience. But in practice, it has served ideas forced into experience, not gathered from it.
We've failed to attend to the actual nature of experience, so philosophy has become preoccupied with trivial, artificial problems. They can't be solved, and they should be abandoned.
What has been completely divided in philosophical discourse into man and world, inner and outer, self and not self, subject and object, individual and social, private and public, etc., are in actuality parties in life transactions. The philosophical problem of trying to get them together is artificial. On the basis of fact, it needs to be replaced by consideration of the conditions under which they occur as distinctions, and of the special uses served by the distinctions.
We make distinctions in our thinking, but they're not metaphysical dichotomies that exist before and apart from our thinking. So, for example, it may be useful to distinguish subjective features from objective features in watching a frightening movie. We distinguish mental failures from bodily failures in treating illness, and basic features differ from options in purchasing a car. But it doesn't follow that subject and object, mind and body, or basics and options actually exist apart from each other. They're not like shattered pieces of Humpty Dumpty waiting for some philosopher to put them back together again. This has revolutionary implications. The traditional metaphysical categories of philosophy, such as subject, object, mind, body, experience, nature, fact, and value, are merely distinctions made by reflection. They have no metaphysical status in reality. They're not metaphysically different things in the world. So Dewey, drawing on the work of Peirce and James, insists that experience is a unified exchange or transaction between organism and environment. It's an active unity of subject and object. Here it's crucial to understand that Dewey doesn't use the common word experience in its conventional sense. For Dewey, experience is neither simply the subject that experiences, nor the object that is experienced. It's not merely the interaction of a subject and object that exists separately from their interaction. Instead, subject and object are unified and related. They're partial features within the ongoing unity that is experience.
Experience is double-barreled in that it recognizes in its primary integrity no division between act and material, subject and object, but contains them both in an unanalyzed totality. Thing and thought, as James says in the same connection, are single-barreled. They refer to products discriminated by reflection out of primary experience.
Dewey's integrated view of experience, developed at length in his masterpiece, Experience and Nature, finds expression throughout his work.
An organism does not live in an environment. It lives by means of an environment. The processes of living are enacted by the environment as truly as by the organism, for they are an integration.
Dewey constantly struggled to find adequate language to express this point. In part, his efforts were responses to critics who failed to grasp his radically novel view. He abandoned the term interaction in favor of transaction, trying to stress that the parties are defined by their interrelation. They have no independent or prior existence. Finally, he even contemplated abandoning the term experience in favor of the word culture.
Because of my growing realization that the historical obstacles which prevented understanding of my use of the word experience are, for all practical purposes, insurmountable, I would substitute the term culture to designate the inclusive subject matter which characteristically modern, post-medieval philosophy breaks up into dualisms.
Dewey says philosophers have to consider the context that shapes their own reflections. This includes what he calls the background of inquiry and the selective interest that guides it. Our interests are inevitably selective. He says even objectivity doesn't mark the absence of interest, but rather the presence of a particular useful interest. If a philosophy of experience, what Dewey sometimes calls metaphysics, is to be objective, it must allow us to identify and use the pervasive, generic, irreducible features of our actual experience. Dewey discusses at length the many features that pervade our experience. He highlights seven main characteristics of experience. Let me list them briefly. Experience is unstable, continuous, historical, qualitative, reflective, meaningful, and irreducibly social. Let's examine these traits a little more closely. First, experience is always changing. Nothing in experience is absolutely fixed or unchanging. At best, it's only relatively stable. Dewey says many philosophers, in their quests for certainty, merely claim an ultimate eternal reality for their own values. But he says values can be defined only through concrete social action. And so values are both relative and subject to change in the press of events. Second, experience is continuous. Events are not discrete and unconnected. They're related in and through time. Connections, continuities, changing in the direction of, and being in transition toward are pervasive features of experience. Third, experience is also historical. The connections within experience consist of beginnings, middles, and endings, initiations, underways, and consummations and frustrations. We may have ends in view, But Dewey says there are no final ends or outcomes of fate, as many traditional philosophies and religions have claimed. Even means and ends are simply different temporal relations within experience. Today's end is tomorrow's means. Fourth, experience is qualitative. Each particular experience has an immediate, ineffable quality that makes it just that particular experience, that tedious job, that concert, that mountain rainstorm. We encounter this qualitative character of experience directly and immediately. We can only attempt to describe these qualities in later reflection about our experience.
Things in their immediacy are unknown and unknowable, not because they are remote or behind some impenetrable veil of sensation of ideas, but because knowledge is a memorandum of conditions of their appearance, concerned, that is, with sequences, coexistences, relations. Immediate things may be pointed to by words, but not described or defined.
Dewey emphasizes that experience is neither subjective nor objective. Rather, it's the unity of both. So, for example, if you're watching a movie, experience, in its largest sense, is the combination of the movie and you're watching it. It's the unity, you watching the movie, that's sad or boring or terrifying or funny. Depending on our purposes, we can say that you were sad or that the movie was sad. But in actual experience, qualities are traits of the unity of subject and object. The fifth central characteristic of experience is that it's reflective. When we think about the causes of today's experience, we gain more control of our future experience. For example, when we experience nagging pain, doctors may look past the painful symptoms to investigate the causes of the pain. They may discover disease, develop a new treatment, and better control tomorrow's illness. Sixth, Dewey implicitly believes that experience is meaningful. By communicating with one another, events become objects with meaning. Experience is funded and enriched. Language makes this possible as it operates in and through the lives of a social group.
When an event has meaning, its potential consequences become its integral and funded feature. When the potential consequences are important and repeated, they form the very nature and essence of a thing, its defining, identifying, and distinguishing form. As meaning, future consequences already belong to the thing.
Seventh and finally, experience is irreducibly social. Dewey doesn't simply say that we live with one another. He claims that social processes form the character of our experience. Experience has meaning only in a social setting. Like his friend and colleague at Chicago, George Herbert Mead, Dewey argues that the self is fundamentally social. The social is the inclusive philosophic idea. It's more inclusive than the physical, organic, or mental characteristics that become manifest only in social participation and communication.
The social furnished the terms in which any consistent empirical philosophy must speak.
This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.
John Dewey was concerned with logic and inquiry throughout his entire career. His early book entitled Studies in Logical Theory led William James to speak of the Chicago School of Pragmatism with Dewey as its leader. In discussing logic and inquiry, Dewey's starting point is straightforward. Human beings think, reason, and inquire in an effort to reach their goals. If all our desires were satisfied naturally, without effort, thinking would have no practical value. It would be pragmatically useless. But Dewey points out that our desires are not always satisfied. This takes effort. We often find we can't reach our goals, or, having reached them, that we should have aimed at other goals. So if we seek satisfaction, appreciation, and enjoyment, we have to inquire into and criticize our own experience.
Philosophy is inherently criticism. Having its distinctive position among various modes of criticism in its generality. A criticism of criticisms, as it were. Criticism is discriminating judgment, careful appraisal. And judgment is appropriately termed criticism wherever the subject matter of discrimination concerns goods or values.
Charles Peirce, the American philosopher and mathematician who founded pragmatism and who significantly influenced Dewey, makes clear that this new philosophical criticism and discrimination depend on new methods and procedures of inquiry.
Modern methods have created modern science, and this century, and especially the last 25 years, have done more to create new methods than any former equal period. We live in the very age of methods. Even mathematics and astronomy have put on new faces. Chemistry and physics are on completely new tracks. Linguistics, history, mythology, sociology, biology are all getting studied in new ways. This is the age of methods.
Dewey says that the philosopher, unlike the sociologist and anthropologist, must evaluate how people ought to think as much as how they actually do think. The philosopher seeks to find a pattern of successful inquiry.
We know that some methods of inquiry are better than others, in just the same way in which we know that some methods of surgery, farming, road making, navigating, or whatnot are better than others. It does not follow in any of these cases that the better methods are ideally perfect, or that they are regulative or normative because of conformity to some absolute form.
Dewey's view about good and bad methods of inquiry has three important consequences. First, contrary to most previous philosophy, we can't derive the way we ought to think from some laws of logic or rules of reason. Instead, our logic and our rules must be derived from actual inquiries. Put in philosophical terms, our epistemology must be derived from our metaphysics. Put more plainly, our theories have to be derived from our actions. Traditional philosophers discuss concepts, logical relations. They're noted for thinking and pondering rather than inquiring and acting. But Dewey makes action primary. Action is the essence of his pragmatism. Action is the central thesis of his book, Logic.
The theory, in summary form, is that all logical forms arise within the operation of inquiry and are concerned with control of inquiry so that it may yield warranted assertions. This conception implies much more than that logical forms are disclosed or come to light when we reflect upon processes of inquiry that are in use. Of course it means that, but it also means that the forms originate in operations of inquiry.
Second, again contrary to most previous philosophy, Dewey argues that any deficiencies of inquiry can be corrected only by further inquiry. Inquiry can improve itself by itself.
The problem, reduced to its lowest terms, is whether inquiry can develop, in its own ongoing course, the logical standards and forms to which further inquiry shall submit. One might reply by saying that it can, because it has. One might even challenge the objector to produce a single instance of improvement in scientific methods not produced in and by the self-corrective process of inquiry.
Third, Dewey says that a pattern of inquiry may illuminate and improve actual inquiries, but it can't abstractly deduce or prejudge them.
The search for the pattern of inquiry is checked and controlled by knowledge of the kinds of inquiry that have and that have not worked. Through comparison contrast, we ascertain how and why certain means and agencies have provided warrantably assertable conclusions, while others have not.
Dewey begins to describe the pattern of inquiry by defining it.
Inquiry is the controlled or directed transformation of an indeterminate situation into one that is so determinate in its constituent distinctions and relations as to convert the elements of the original situation into a unified whole.
Some philosophers object to this. Bertrand Russell, the famous 20th century British philosopher, complains about Dewey's definition of inquiry.
It would apply to the operations of a drill sergeant in transforming a collection of raw recruits into a regiment, or a bricklayer transforming a heap of bricks into a house. and yet it would be impossible to say that the drill sergeant is inquiring into the recruits, or the bricklayer into the bricks.
In short, Russell thinks Dewey mistakenly makes action rather than truth the object of his logic and his philosophy.
Knowledge, if Dewey is right, cannot be any part of the ends of life. It is merely a means to other satisfactions. This view, to those who have been much engaged in the pursuit of knowledge, is distasteful.
Dewey believes truth is inseparable from action, and that knowledge is inseparable from active efforts to know. This doesn't mean that the bricklayer is inquiring into the bricks. Dewey says the bricklayer inquires into how he might intelligently transform a pile of bricks into a house. Unlike the bricklayer, the drill sergeant, and many others who solve immediate problems, the philosopher doesn't aim directly to improve existing situations. He inquires into the features shared by all inquiries. He seeks what Dewey calls a pattern of inquiry. This pattern begins with an actual indeterminate situation. Dewey calls this the antecedent condition of inquiry. An indeterminate situation is questionable, disturbed, confused, ambiguous, obscure. Action is needed, but it's unclear how the organism should respond to its environment. To begin resolving an indeterminate situation, we must recognize and state the problem. Simply stating the problem at least changes an indeterminate situation into a determinate one.
It is a familiar and significant saying that a problem well put is half solved. To mistake the problem involved is to cause subsequent inquiry to be irrelevant or to go astray. On the other hand, to set up a problem that does not grow out of an actual situation is to start on a course of dead work. Nonetheless dead because the work is busy work. Problems that are self-set are mere excuses for seeming to do something intellectual, something that has the semblance but not the substance of scientific activity.
Next, we have to determine a reasonable or plausible solution. Dewey says no indeterminate situation is completely indeterminate. Each one exists against a background of definite facts. We never begin with total doubt, in spite of the claims of some philosophers like René Descartes. For example, Dewey suggests that when a fire alarm's sounded in a crowded building, much is unknown about how to respond, but much is known, such as the fact that the building has stairs and exits at fixed places, that others in the building are acting calmly, and so on. Dewey says these factors are fixed in existence, and we must fix them in observation to define the problem. For instance, you could ride down the elevator, walk down the stairs, or jump out a window. At first, these possibilities may be vague, little more than suggestions. To become a genuine idea, Dewey says these suggestions must be subjected to reason and inquiry. That process would be pretty quick in this example of a burning building. Reason will develop the meanings of the suggestions in relation to one another. It'll discover whether they can resolve the situation. You may rule out the elevator and the window, opting instead for the stairs. But reasoning alone is pragmatically insufficient, no matter how attractive it may be to lazy philosophers and armchair thinkers. The fourth step of inquiry and the final test of any proposed solution is in action. To complete the example, you must actually walk down the stairs and escape the fire. Dewey explains that common sense inquiries and scientific inquiries differ in their subject matter and in the ends they seek, otherwise they're similar. We can understand how science historically developed from common sense. Dewey says common sense is more concerned with the immediate quality of experience, while science is more concerned with relations between particular qualities.
In science, since meanings are determined on the ground of their relation as meanings to one another, relations become the objects of inquiry, and qualities are relegated to a secondary status, playing a part only as far as they assist in institution of relations.
Dewey then goes on to describe how science now ignores the qualitative features of the things it studies.
First, tertiary qualities were eliminated. It was recognized that moral qualities are not agencies in determining the structure of nature. Then, secondary qualities, the wet, dry, hot, cold, light, heavy, which were the explanatory principles of physical phenomena in Greek science, were ejected. But so-called primary qualities took their place, as with Newton and Locke. It was not until the threshold of our time was reached that scientific inquirers perceived that their own problems and methods required an interpretation of primary qualities in terms of relations, such as position, motion, and temporal span. In the structure of distinctively scientific objects, these relations are indifferent to qualities.
By describing how scientific inquiry is related to common sense, Dewey exposes the artificiality of a so-called problem that's been central to almost all Western philosophies since Bacon, Descartes, and the rise of modern science. The apparent problem is this: how does the physical subject matter of the natural sciences relate to everyday objects in common sense terms? A physicist would describe a table in terms of atomic structure and relative motion and position. But someone eating breakfast at the table would describe its deep oak color, wax buildup, uneven legs, and family heirloom status. How do these accounts relate to one another? Is the physicist's table more real, whatever that might mean, than the breakfast eater's table? Dewey says the descriptions don't indicate two different levels of reality. They simply indicate that a physicist and a breakfast eater have different objectives. The breakfast eater wants to observe and describe the qualities and features of the table. The physicist, on the other hand, ignores those qualitative features. He doesn't directly experience the table as such. For him, the table becomes an object of knowledge. He wants to discover the existential relations, the physical and chemical properties that make the table what it is. So the breakfast eater's table and the physicist's table are equally real, but they're different.
My theory of the relation of cognitive experiences to other modes of experience is based upon the fact that connections exist in the most immediate non-cognitive experience. And when the experienced situation becomes problematic, the connections are developed into distinctive objects of knowledge, whether of common sense or of science.
Dewey's account of inquiry does for philosophy, epistemology, and logic what Einstein's theory of relativity did for physics. In his work, The Quest for Certainty, Dewey calls his own philosophy a Copernican revolution, implicitly rejecting Immanuel Kant's similar claim for his own thought.
Philosophy has to focus reflection upon needs congruous to present life. To interpret the conclusions of science with respect to their consequences for our beliefs about purposes and values in all phases of life. The old center was mind knowing by means of an equipment of powers complete within itself and merely exercised upon an antecedent external material equally complete in itself. The new center is indefinite interactions taking place within a course of nature, which is not fixed and complete, but which is capable of direction to new and different results through the mediation of intentional operations.
Dewey's theory of inquiry is frequently called instrumentalism. This is an appropriate label in this sense. First, as we've heard, Dewey believes an organism thinks in order to control a difficult, confused, unsatisfactory environment. Not all thinking's successful, so Dewey holds that logical thinking simply is widely successful thinking. In this sense, logic and inquiry are instrumental or useful. Dewey's instrumentalism asserts that the actual results of thinking are the ultimate measure of its worth. In other words, successful inquiry is instrumental. Successful inquiry transforms an originally indeterminate situation and integrates it, or harmonizes the organism with the environment. Dewey's instrumental view of inquiry leads to a radically new instrumental or pragmatic view of truth. This new view reconstructs his earlier accounts of truth, which no longer satisfy him. Like William James, Dewey is looking for a new way of thinking. James had first outlined how a pragmatic method of inquiry has important implications for a theory of truth. James called his pragmatism a new name for an old way of thinking. But its sweeping differences from earlier accounts of truth suggest that the pragmatic theory really is an old name for a new way of thinking.
Riding now on the front of this wave of scientific logic, pragmatists say truth in our ideas and beliefs means the same thing that it means in science. It means, they say, nothing but this, that ideas which themselves are but parts of our experience become true, just insofar as they help us to get into satisfactory relation with other parts of our experience. A new opinion counts as true just in proportion as it gratifies the individual's desire to assimilate the novel in his experience to his beliefs in stock.
James argues that several common ideas about truth are pragmatically useless and meaningless. Some think that truth is independent of human experience and need, that we simply discover rather than make truth, and that there's some final, incorrigible, absolute truth. He says a pragmatic account must push past these empty, unfounded notions.
Truth, as any dictionary will tell you, is a property of certain of our ideas. It means their agreement with reality. Pragmatists and intellectualists both accept this definition as a matter of course. They begin to quarrel only after the question is raised as to what may precisely be meant by the term agreement and what by the term reality, when reality is taken as something for our ideas to agree with. Pragmatism asks its usual question. Grant an idea or belief to be true, it says, what concrete difference will its being true make in anyone's actual life? What, in short, is the truth's cash value in experiential terms? The moment pragmatism asks this question, it sees the answer. True ideas are those that we can assimilate, validate, corroborate, and verify. False ideas are those that we cannot. The truth of an idea is not a stagnant property inherent in it. Truth happens to an idea. It becomes true, is made true by events. Its verity is, in fact, an event, a process. The process, namely, of its verifying itself, its verification, its validity, is the process of its validation.
Dewey agrees with James that truth is made and that inquiry makes it. They agree that there are no final absolute truths. Dewey says the actual investigator doesn't seek so-called true beliefs. He seeks beliefs that are justified by inquiry. He believes that the very notion of truth has been bound up in traditional philosophic quests for certainty and for accounts of reality beyond human experience. So Dewey's often ready to abandon altogether the whole notion of truth. For him, truth always must be justified by applying it to the most recent circumstances.
If we put ourselves in the attitude of a scientific inquirer in asking what is the meaning of truth per se, there spring up before us those ideas which are actively employed in the mastery of new fields, in the organization of new materials. This is the essential difference between truth and dogma, between the living and the dead and decaying. Above all, it is in the region of moral truth that this perception stands out. Moral truths that are not recreated in application to the urgencies of the passing hour, no matter how true in the place and time of their origin, are pernicious and misleading, that is, false.
How can social life best renew itself? This is the inescapable, central, most basic problem for social inquiry. Dewey says it's an educational problem.
Adult members, possess the knowledge and the customs of the group. Immature members must be not merely physically preserved in adequate numbers, but they must be initiated into the interests, purposes, information, skill, and practices of the mature members. Otherwise, the group will cease its characteristic life. Society exists through a process of transmission quite as much as biological life. Without this communication, social life could not survive.
Dewey's writings on education are among his best known and most influential, and often least understood. Dewey has a special meaning for the term education, as he has a special meaning for the term experience. He makes a crucial distinction between education and schooling. Education is the broader term, and schooling is narrower. Schooling is a part or subset of what Dewey calls education. Fortunately, he defines these terms clearly.
Schools are indeed one important method of the transmission which forms the dispositions of the immature, but it is only one means, and, compared with other agencies, a relatively superficial means. Only as we have grasped the necessity of more fundamental and persistent modes of tuition can we make sure of placing the scholastic methods in their true context.
Dewey links education with the processes of communication.
Men live in a community in virtue of the things which they have in common, and communication is the way in which they come to possess things in common. Not only is social life identical with communication, but all communication, and hence all genuine social life, is educative. To be a recipient of a communication is to have an enlarged and changed experience, nor is the one who communicates left unaffected.
Dewey says a genuine society is not only physically close, it must also include communication and its results. Otherwise, relations among individuals are merely mechanical. Without true communication, men and women only manipulate one another like machines, paying no attention to the quality of the other's experience. Dewey believes that we educate when we meaningfully renew social life through communication. This view implies much of his far-reaching political philosophy, social criticism, and ethics. Major social institutions like the government, the economy, the family, the workplace, the legal system, community organizations, and religious traditions have broader and deeper educational consequences than the schools, even though education is not their immediate objective. Accordingly, these institutions can be evaluated and reconstructed in terms of their educational failures and successes.
It may be said, without exaggeration, that the measure of the worth of any social institution, economic, domestic, political, legal, religious, is its effect in enlarging and improving experience. In dealing with the young, the need of training is too evident. The pressure to accomplish a change in their attitude and habits is too urgent to leave these consequences wholly out of account. Since our chief business with them is to enable them to share in a common life, we cannot help considering whether or not we are forming powers that will secure this ability.
The educational effects of schooling are small, few, and temporary compared to the effects of these broader social institutions. Yet there's an undeniable social need for formal education. In fact, Dewey says the need's never been greater. Our increasingly complex society and our explosive gains in knowledge immensely widen the gap between the activities of the young and old.
As civilization advances, learning by direct sharing in the pursuits of grown-ups becomes increasingly difficult, except in the case of the less advanced occupations. Much of what adults do is so remote in space and in meaning that playful imitation is less and less adequate to reproduce its spirit. Ability to share effectively in adult activities thus depends upon a prior training given with this end in view. Without formal education, it is not possible to transmit all the resources and achievements of a complex society.
While schooling is full of promise, Dewey is quick to point out that the dangers are also large. The chief danger is that school subjects and activities may seem remote from actual life. They may seem abstract, artificial, dead. Students see a gap between their schools and the so-called real world, but Dewey says this is solvable.
To avoid a split between what men consciously know, because they are aware of having learned it by a specific job of learning, and what they unconsciously know because they have absorbed it in the formation of their characters by intercourse with others, becomes an increasingly delicate task with every development of special schooling.
Dewey addresses several other important educational questions. What is the goal of education? How can we realize that goal most effectively? What are the implications for schools and for society as a whole? Dewey says the goal of education is growth. And the goal of growth is nothing but further growth. The most important condition for growth is immaturity. He stresses that immaturity is not simply the absence of maturity, but rather the presence of a potential to develop. Dewey notes that every adult resents the imputation that he has no more possibilities for growth. Anyone who can learn from experience and use that learning in future experience can continue to acquire habits.
A habit is a form of executive skill, of efficiency in doing. A habit is an active control of the environment through control of the organs of action. If we think of a habit simply as a change wrought in the organism, ignoring the fact that this change consists in ability to effect subsequent conformity to environment, as wax conforms to the seal which impresses it. But habits transform the environment and mean formation of intellectual and emotional disposition, as well as an increase in ease, economy, and efficiency of action.
Dewey says fixed habits are so well established that they're always available, but once they're fixed, habits may become, over time, merely routine habits, even bad ones. Our capacity to develop new habits may decline, and the capacity for further development, growth, and education is thus reduced.
Habits reduce themselves to routine ways of acting, or degenerate into ways of action to which we are enslaved, just in the degree in which intelligence is disconnected from them. Routine habits are unthinking habits. Bad habits are habits so severed from reason that they are opposed to the conclusions of conscious deliberation and decision. There can be no doubt of the tendency of organic plasticity to lessen with growing years. Settling down means aversion to change and a resting on past achievements. Only an environment which secures the full use of intelligence in the process of forming habits can counteract this tendency.
To educate, then, is to continually develop the capacity for new habits and continually to renew this capacity itself. Dewey defines education as growth in this sense. Dewey's view of education fits neatly with his theory of experience and his theory of inquiry. He claims that education has no goal outside of growth. He also claims that there's no reality independent of experience and no standard of logic independent of inquiry.
Our net conclusion is that life is development and that developing, growing, is life. Translated into its educational equivalents, this means, one, that the educational process has no end beyond itself. It is its own end. And that, two, the educational process is one of continual reorganizing, reconstructing, transforming.
For Dewey, education is possible only in a genuinely democratic society. Democracy can survive only if its citizens become educated and grow. Only active education, understood as growth, creates and recreates shared activities and meanings. Only active education creates the freedom needed to realize shared ideals. Democracy is a way of life rather than just a form of government, and it seeks and requires its citizens to have freely shared lives and values. Dewey also believes philosophy is one with education. For him, experience, education, inquiry, and democracy mutually imply each other. They constitute a unified, coherent perspective. With this in mind, we can better understand why Dewey says his book, Democracy and Education, is the fullest statement of his philosophy.
If we are willing to conceive education as the process of forming fundamental dispositions, intellectual and emotional, toward nature and fellow men, philosophy may even be defined as the general theory of education. Unless a philosophy is to remain symbolic or verbal, or a sentimental indulgence for a few, or else mere arbitrary dogma, its auditing of past experience and its program of values must take effect in conduct.
Because Dewey believes that education forms the fundamental habits of individuals, he says education is the fundamental method of social progress. It's more effective, he argues, than mere legislation or violence. Therefore, education is a social duty.
I believe that the community's duty to education is, therefore, its paramount moral duty. By law and punishment, by social agitation and discussion, society can regulate and form itself in a more or less haphazard and chance way. But through education, society can formulate its own purposes, can organize its own means and resources, and thus shape itself with definiteness and economy in the direction in which it wishes to move. I believe that when society once recognizes the possibilities in this direction and the obligations which these possibilities impose, it is impossible to conceive of the resources of time, attention, and money which will be put at the disposal of the educator.
Dewey's proposals for overhauling school policies and practices have elicited much praise. William Kilpatrick, Dewey's colleague in philosophy and education at Columbia University, is among his supporters.
First, Dewey has brought increased human interest into school life and work. Interest in the pupil as a living person, and interest in current social affairs. It is doubtful that, outside of certain parochial schools, and possibly a few others, there is to be found in this country a single child whose school life has not been somewhat happier because John Dewey has lived. Second, wherever the teacher works consciously to stir pupil initiative and aims consciously to encourage pupil responsibility, the probabilities are that such a teacher has directly or indirectly been influenced by the teachings of John Dewey. Third, wherever the aim is to extend democracy farther and more consistently into school affairs, teachers have profited by what John Dewey has taught.
But Dewey's views on education have also been severely criticized by different groups from different perspectives. To some, his progressive policies appear too permissive. To others, his views seem too relativistic. Still others worry that Dewey's views are too radical, too humanistic. Some claim he's not too radical, but too conservative. Harry Wells, a 20th century American Marxist, makes this charge clear.
Dewey's pragmatic theory of education would conceal the S through making bourgeois indoctrination appear as the flowering of the inner being of the child. Dewey would turn out workers well indoctrinated with low wages, speed up, long hours, an army of unemployed, and all those social and scientific values so close to the heart of the capitalist class.
Dewey thinks these criticisms are based on misunderstandings of his philosophy, that his critics concentrate on only one or another element of his theories. Dewey says we must overcome the splits and dualisms that now pervade formal education. The separation of school and society, of child and curriculum, of the liberal arts and the vocations, of the mental and the physical, and of those who are schooled and those who aren't. Dewey responds to almost every educational issue, and so to almost every philosophical issue, by denying the dualisms assumed by existing theories. So to ask whether a school's organization should be driven by the interests of the child or the content of the curriculum raises an artificial question. To ask whether formal education should be liberal or vocational requires assumptions not based in experience. Such dichotomies are the tedious fictions of those philosophers who fail to inquire into the nature of schooling as it actually affects us. Dewey details this problem of artificial dichotomies in discussing the child in the curriculum. When educators separate the child in the curriculum in educational practice, they quickly divide into warring camps.
Discipline is the watchword of those who magnify the course of study. Interest, that of those who blazon the child upon their banner. Guidance and control are the catchwords of one school, freedom and initiative of the other. What, then, is the problem? It is just to get rid of the prejudicial notion that there is some gap in kind, as distinct from degree, between the child's experience and the various forms of subject matter that make up the course of study. Abandon the notion of subject matter as something fixed and ready-made in itself, outside the child's experience. Cease thinking of the child's experience as also something fluent, embryonic, vital, and we realize that the child and curriculum are simply two limits which define a single process.
Dewey argues that effective education requires that the school and society be joined. The school must extend into society, and society must reach into the school. Otherwise, genuine education can't take place. Instead, we produce bookishness, motor activity without meaning, specialized knowledge without the intelligence to direct it, and pseudo-intellectual spirit rather than a social spirit. He says this social sense and these shared aims characterize the playground, but not the typical classroom. But when real social concerns enter the classroom, there's an immense change of atmosphere.
As one enters a busy kitchen in which a group of children are actively engaged in the preparation of food, the psychological difference, the change from more or less passive and inert recipiency and restraint to one of buoyant, outgoing energy is so obvious as fairly to strike one in the face.
Dewey's remarkable book, Schools of Tomorrow, is filled with examples of successful reforms actually enacted in scores of schools throughout America. The captions on its many illustrations describe these changes as here.
To learn to think, we must exercise our limbs. Songs and games help arithmetic. Real gardens for city nature study. The boys like cooking more than the girls do. And solving problems in school as they would have to be met out of school.
Dewey also stresses that our society must be formally educated to live a free democratic life. A free society, he emphasizes, doesn't happen naturally and effortlessly. It has to be educated to understand and appreciate freedom.
If we train our children to take orders, to do things simply because they are told so, and fail to give them confidence to act and think for themselves, we are putting an almost insurmountable obstacle in the way of overcoming the present defects of our system and of establishing the truth of democratic ideals. Our state is founded on freedom. But when we train the state of tomorrow, we allow it just as little freedom as possible. Children in school must be allowed freedom so that they will know what its use means when they become the controlling body.
Dewey insists that freedom and educational development must be extended to all members of society. This inclusiveness is central to the very meaning of democracy itself. If we don't have shared opportunity, common experience, and communication, then government of, for, and by the people can't exist.
It is fatal for a democracy to permit the formation of fixed classes. There must not be one system for the children of parents who have more leisure, and another for the children of those who are wage earners. The over-bookish education for some, and over-practical education for others, brings about a division of mental and moral habits, ideals, and outlook. The democracy which proclaims equality of opportunity as its ideal requires an education in which learning and social application, ideas and practice, work and recognition of the meaning of what is done are united from the beginning and for all.
This is the end of take number one.
This is tape number 2 on John Dewey.
John Dewey says philosophy must inquire into the real needs of democracy in America, into society's social problems, tendencies, workforces, and possibilities for improvement. So Dewey's social and political philosophy emphasizes that culture should be democratically reconstructed.
The beginnings of a culture stripped of egoistic illusions is the perception that we have as yet no culture, that our culture is something to achieve, to create.
Dewey's most important social and political writings are clearly rooted in his theories of experience, inquiry, and education. He wrote these relatively late in his career. They're found in several books. Their spirit is strikingly captured in an address first read by Dewey at a dinner in his honor in New York City in 1939.
At the present time, the frontier is moral, not physical. The period of free lands that seemed boundless in extent has vanished. Unused resources are now human rather than material. They are found in the waste of grown men and women who are without the chance to work, and in the young men and young women who find doors closed where there was once opportunity. It is a challenge to do for the critical and complex conditions of today what the men of an earlier day did for simpler conditions.
Democracy doesn't perpetuate itself automatically. It demands persistent social inquiry, imaginative vision, and courageous action. Democracy makes demands on people, on you and me, because it's fundamentally a way of life, not simply a form of government.
Democracy, as a way of life, is controlled by a working faith in the possibilities of human nature. This faith may be enacted in statutes, but it is only on paper, unless it is put in force in the attitudes which human beings display to one another in all the incidents and relations of daily life. To denounce Nazism for intolerance, cruelty, and stimulation of hatred amounts to fostering insincerity if in our personal relations to other persons, if in our daily walk and conversation, we are moved by racial, color, or other class prejudice. For what is the faith of democracy except faith in the capacity of the intelligence of the common man to respond with common sense to the free play of facts and ideas which are secured by effective communication?
Dewey's call for reform is nowhere clearer than in his analysis of liberalism. Most generally, Dewey understands liberalism to be theories and actions that support intelligence, individualism, and freedom. They oppose ignorance, mere authority, and violence. Given this unusually broad definition, a great many people on the political right, left, and center are all committed to liberalism, in Dewey's sense. Dewey clearly recognizes that liberals have stood for different things at different times. John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, and Adam Smith were committed to the innate individuality of all people, to self-evident individual rights, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property and happiness. These early liberals supported government primarily to protect individual rights. They believed that governments that infringe on these rights are illegitimate and should be overthrown. And Dewey observes that this early liberalism understands intelligence to be the innate capacity to grasp supposedly self-evident moral truths and economic laws.
The whole temper of this philosophy is individualistic, in the sense in which individualism is opposed to organized social action. It held to the primacy of the individual over the state, not only in time, but in moral authority. It defined the individual in terms of liberties of thought and action already possessed by him in some mysterious, ready-made fashion, and which it was the sole business of the state to safeguard. Reason was also made an inherent endowment of the individual, expressed in men's moral relations to one another, but not sustained and developed because of these relations. It followed that the great enemy of individual liberty was thought to be government, because of its tendency to encroach upon the innate liberties of individuals to property already possessed, and later to the production of wealth and to economic activity.
But this view of government and society wasn't shared by later liberals. David Hume, Jeremy Bentham, and John Stuart Mill were skeptical of so-called self-evident truths. They argued that self-evident beliefs are not logically self-justified to anyone. Instead, they're simply psychologically obvious to those who hold them. So they claimed that actions and institutions must be judged by their consequences rather than their origins. Still other writers, also dedicated to freedom, individualism, and intelligence, developed less individualistic accounts of human nature. Romantic poets and writers such as Samuel Taylor Coleridge, William Wordsworth, Thomas Carlyle, and John Ruskin emphasized the organic, interconnected character of society. Recent liberals now adopt a more utilitarian, communal approach to government. They advocate organized collective social action. They argue that government can create rights for its citizens rather than merely protecting pre-existing rights of individuals. Clearly, these various strands of liberalism are incompatible. Their theoretical differences lead to major practical differences. As a result, Dewey says liberalism has become confused, wavering, and internally divided at an impasse.
Thus, from various sources and under various influences, there developed an inner split in liberalism. There are still those who call themselves liberals, who define liberalism in terms of the old opposition between the province of organized social action and the province of purely individual initiative and effort. In the name of liberalism, they are jealous of every extension of governmental activity. Wittingly or unwittingly, they still provide the intellectual system of apologetics for the existing economic regime, which they strangely, it would seem ironically, uphold as a regime of individual liberty for all. But other liberals today are committed to the principle that organized society must use its powers to establish the conditions under which the mass of individuals can possess actual, as distinct from merely legal, liberty.
Dewey says liberalism hasn't effectively solved or even addressed contemporary problems. Liberals have failed to reconstruct, in theory and in practice, their original values of individualism, freedom, and intelligence. They haven't brought these values into harmony with contemporary social conditions. Dewey says all this happened because liberals have lacked an historic sense.
They put forward their ideas as immutable truths, good at all times and places. They had no idea of historic relativity, either in general or in its application to themselves. The tragedy is that although these liberals were the sworn foes of political absolutism, they were themselves absolutists in the social creed they formulated.
Dewey argues that recent liberals, whether Republicans, Democrats, or independents, have been guided by outdated interpretations of freedom, individualism, and intelligence, and now act in ways that actually oppose these values. In short, traditional liberal theory itself now inhibits our ability to realize liberal values in social life. Dewey calls for a renascent, renewed liberalism and proposes a three-step strategy. To be effective, liberalism must first develop historical perspective. It has to acknowledge that today's social conditions have made traditional liberal theories obsolete. Secondly, Renaissance liberalism must reconstruct traditional liberal values in light of current social realities. Third, it has to actively reconstruct social institutions, practices, and relations. A new liberalism must involve action. It must translate new theory into new practice. To provide liberalism with historical perspective, Dewey highlights sweeping social changes that have taken place since liberalism was first formulated. Now there are new material possibilities.
Thanks to science and technology, we now live in an age of potential plenty. But the habits of desire and effort that were bred in the age of scarcity do not readily subordinate themselves. Even now, when there is a vision of an age of abundance, and when the vision is supported by hard fact, it is material security as an end that appeals to most, rather than the way of living which this security makes possible.
Dewey calls insecurity the child of scarcity. He notes that social changes since the Industrial Revolution are linked to a radical shift in the nature and source of insecurity in contemporary society.
The conditions that generate insecurity for the many no longer spring from nature. They are found in institutions and arrangements that are within deliberate human control. Surely, this change marks one of the greatest revolutions that has taken place in all human history. Because of it, insecurity is not now the motive to work and sacrifice, but to despair.
But Dewey says material abundance and new forms of insecurity have not been created by individual, isolated, unplanned labor.
It demands no great power of intelligence to see that under present conditions, the isolated individual is well nigh helpless. Concentration and corporate organization are the rule. But the concentration and corporate organization are still controlled in their operation by ideas that were institutionalized in eons of separate individual effort. But that society itself should see to it that a cooperative industrial order be instituted, one that is consonant with the realities of production enforced by an era of machinery and power, is so novel an idea to the general mind that its mere suggestion is hailed with abusive epithets, sometimes with imprisonment.
Dewey begins reconstructing the meaning of individualism by analyzing its nearly total submergence in our society today. Our lives, he argues, are now marked by economic insecurity, political apathy broken by confused spasms of concern, and deep decline in the roles of religion and family, which no longer integrate and direct our lives. Unthinking conformities growing, as is crime and disregard for other people and our environment. More and more we try unsuccessfully to solve social problems externally through legislation, rather than internally by forming character, values, and shared activities. These developments indicate that old loyalties and relations have virtually disappeared, but new loyalties have not been forged. The result is what Dewey calls the lost individual.
In consequence, individuals are confused and bewildered. It would be difficult to find in history an epoch as lacking in solid and assured objects of belief and approved ends of action as is the present. Individuals vibrate between a past that is intellectually too empty to give stability and a present that is too diversely crowded and chaotic to afford balance or direction to ideas and emotion.
This point is crucial. Individuality is a social product. Without appropriate social conditions, individuality is impossible. Some people think individuality is simply a matter of being different at all costs from everyone else, driving a different car, listening to different music, having a different haircut or different clothes. But Dewey says simply being different has nothing to do with genuine individuality. It has everything to do with mindless conformity. Whether you do something just because others do it or avoid something just because others do, the actions of others uncritically direct your life. Others think individuality is simply a matter of personal self-sufficiency, or what Dewey calls ragged individualism. He makes clear that this image is a fiction. Everyone in our complex world is involved in countless social interdependencies, from education to food production, from environmental impacts to healthcare, and from friends and neighbors to the military and economic powers of distant peoples. Dewey says that individuality, when it occurs, is an achievement. It's not a primordial trait inherited by all and maintained only by those few who can escape to private Walden ponds. Dewey distinguishes between a genuine individual and a mere separate organism. This parallels the philosophical distinction between the self and the body. This distinction was made forcefully by the philosopher and sociologist George Herbert Mead, Dewey's friend and colleague at Chicago. The self, Mead observes, is essentially a being that arises in social experience.
We can distinguish very definitely between the self and the body. The body can be there and can operate in a very intelligent fashion without there being a self involved in the experience. The self has the characteristic that it is an object to itself. The individual experiences himself as such, not directly, but only indirectly, from the particular standpoints of other individual members of the same social group, or from the generalized standpoint of the social group as a whole to which he belongs. For he enters his own experience as a self or individual only insofar as he first becomes an object to himself, just as other individuals are objects to him or his experience. And he becomes an object to himself only by taking the attitudes of other individuals toward himself. Such a self is not primarily a physiological organism.
For Dewey, individuality is self-realization, the continuous development of one's potential. Seen in this way, individuality is fragile. It requires the right conditions to grow. And Dewey's Renaissance liberalism is committed to developing the social conditions that permit real individuality to develop. Dewey also develops a new view of freedom, the second enduring value of liberalism.
The real fallacy of classic liberalism lies in the notion that individuals have such a native or original endowment of rights, powers, and wants that all that is required on the side of institutions and laws is to eliminate the obstructions they offer to the free play of the natural equipment of individuals. The removal of obstructions did have a liberating effect upon such individuals as were antecedently possessed of the means, intellectual and economic, to take advantage of the changed social conditions. But it left all others at the mercy of the new social conditions brought about by the freed powers of those advantageously situated. The notion that men are equally free to act if only the same legal arrangements apply equally to all, irrespective of differences in education, in command of capital, and the control of the social environment which is furnished by the institution of property, is a pure absurdity, as facts have demonstrated. The only possible conclusion, both intellectually and practically, is that the attainment of freedom, conceived as power to act in accord with choice, depends upon positive and constructive changes in social arrangements.
Selfishness and greed, Dewey continues, obstruct efforts to make these constructive social changes.
It is not too much to say that the whole significance of the older individualism has now shrunk to a pecuniary scale and measure. One cannot imagine a bitterer comment on any professed individualism than that it subordinates the only creative individuality, that of mind, to the maintenance of a regime which gives the few an opportunity for being shrewd in the management of monetary business.
Dewey's view had far-reaching practical consequences. President Franklin Roosevelt echoed his central themes in an important 1935 speech about America and the New Deal.
A glance at the situation today only too clearly indicates that equality of opportunity as we have known it no longer exists. Our last frontier has long since been reached. And there is practically no more free land. More than half of our people do not live on the farms or on lands and cannot derive a living by cultivating their own property. We are now providing a drab living for our own people. Recently, a careful study showed that our economic life was dominated by some 600-odd corporations who controlled 2/3 of American industry. 10 million small businessmen divided the other third. Put plainly, we are steering a course toward economic oligarchy if we are not there already. Clearly, all this calls for a reappraisal of values. A mere builder of more industrial plants, a creator of more railroad systems, an organizer of more corporations, is as likely to be a danger as a help. The day of the great promoter or the financial titan is over. Our task now is the soberer, less dramatic business of administering resources, of adjusting production to consumption, of distributing wealth and products more equitably, of adapting existing economic organizations to the service of the people.
Roosevelt echoes Dewey's call for a reappraisal and renewal of social values. But Dewey's emphasis on the need for change is even more radical than it may seem at first.
The problem is not merely one of extending to all individuals the traits of economic initiative, opportunity, and enterprise. It is one of forming a new psychological and moral type. I am not anxious to depict the form which this emergent individualism will assume. Indeed, I do not see how it can be described until more progress has been made in its production. But such progress will not be initiated until we cease opposing the socially corporate to the individual, and until we develop a constructively imaginative observation of the role of science and technology in actual society.
Dewey says the members of society are free only if they can grow, but custom, superstition, and violence stand in the way of intelligent social policymaking. Dewey believes people are coerced into superficial agreements with each other. He argues that this superficial conformity easily blinds us to the level of force and violence built into our supposedly democratic society.
Force, rather than intelligence, is built into the procedures of the existing social system, regularly as coercion, in times of crisis, as overt violence. The competitive system, which was thought of by early liberals as the means by which the latent abilities of individuals were to be evoked and directed into socially useful channels, is now, in fact, a state of scarcely disguised battle.
Dewey insists that social change should occur through intelligence rather than violence. This view stands in sharp contrast to those of many other important 20th century theorists. For example, Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, observed in his 1927 book, The Future of an Illusion.
It seems that every civilization must be built up on coercion. It is impossible to do without control of the mass by a minority.
Also in 1927, Chinese Communist Party Chairman Mao Zedong spelled out a now familiar global political strategy that's radically different from Dewey's.
Every communist must grasp the truth. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. We can create schools, create culture, creates mass movements. All things grown out of the barrel of a gun. And only with guns can the whole world be transformed. We are advocates of the abolition of war. We do not want war, but war can only be abolished through war. And in order to get rid of the gun, it is necessary to take up the gun.
Dewey warns that unless we're guided by intelligence rather than guns, even our past social accomplishments may become new and dangerous problems for democracy.
it is no longer possible to hold the simple faith of the Enlightenment that assured advance of science will produce free institutions by dispelling ignorance and superstition. The progress of natural science has been even more rapid and extensive than could have been anticipated, and has created a vast and intricate set of new problems. It has put at the disposal of dictators means of controlling opinion and sentiment of a potency which reduces to a mere shadow all previous agencies at the command of despotic rulers. In consequence, for practically the first time in human history, totalitarian states exist claiming to rest upon the active consent of the governed. While despotic governments are as old as political history, this particular phenomenon is as startlingly unexpected as it is powerful.
Authoritarian methods now offer themselves in new guises.
They come to us claiming to serve the ultimate ends of freedom and equity in a classless totalitarianism. In whatever form they offer themselves, they owe their seductive power to their claim to serve ideal ends. Our first defense is to realize that democracy can be served only by the slow, day-by-day adoption and contagious diffusion in every phase of our common life of methods that are identical with the ends to be reached, and that recourse to monistic, wholesale, absolutist procedures is a betrayal of human freedom, no matter in what guise it presents itself.
For an individual, democracy means sharing responsibly in creating and directing the social forces that affect our lives. To the extent that individuals don't participate in this social decision-making, democracy as self-government doesn't exist. For social groups, democracy means that each member grows in harmony with the others. To the extent that groups don't serve and nurture common interests, democracy as government for the people doesn't exist. Our most pressing need, he says, is to produce a fully and richly democratic culture.
When the machine age has thus perfected its machinery, it will be a means of life and not its despotic master. Democracy will come into its own. For democracy is a name for a life of free and enriching communion. We lie, as Emerson said, in the lap of an immense intelligence. But that intelligence is dormant, and its communications are broken, inarticulate, and faint until it possesses the local community as its medium.
Dewey repeatedly emphasizes that effectively reconstructing democracy, education, logic, and experience, that is, reconstructing our entire culture, requires inquiry. In these situations, the subject matter of inquiry is social rather than physical. We evaluate human action, social organization, and values rather than chromosomes and genes, quarks and quasars, heavy water and fusion. All social inquiry, whether focused on child abuse, drug use, housing needs, consumer wants, or world peace, presupposes that we can properly inquire about values. Dewey's ethics, his theory of valuation, seeks to demonstrate that inquiry about values is possible. So ethics lies at the center of Dewey's cultural criticism.
It is a favorite idea of mine that we are now in the presence of an intellectual crisis, similar to that of the 17th century. Then, the crisis concerned the free creation of new ideas regarding physical nature, ideas that formed the points of departure for new ways of observing and interpreting physical phenomena. Now, the crisis concerns the initiation of new hypotheses regarding man, regarding the nature and significance of those human associations that form the various modes of social phenomena. What philosophy did 3 centuries ago for physical inquiry, it now has the opportunity of doing for social life.
According to earlier philosophies and contemporary popular opinion, facts and values inhabit different realms. Facts are thought to be objective, while values are subjective. Facts are supposedly known through the senses. Values, if they're known at all, are intuited, felt by some sixth sense, or revealed in mystical flashes or transcendental philosophies. According to traditional philosophies, facts are the same facts for everyone, while values are relative and different. Many traditional philosophers have claimed that facts are either true or false, while values are personal expressions or matters of taste. According to many earlier philosophers, this split makes it impossible to inquire into values experimentally. These philosophers believed that statements of fact never lead to or justify statements of value. For example, we may agree about the fact that stealing a cassette player causes grief, but philosophers have argued that such a fact does not logically prove that one ought not to steal. This ought statement follows only if we accept first that one should not do what causes grief. But why accept this value? Efforts to prove this claim require other assumptions about other values, and so on, in an infinite regression. Many earlier philosophers tried to bridge the is-ought gap by showing that some statements of fact logically entail some statements of value. Others, believing there was sleight of hand in these efforts, had declared the gap between fact and value was too wide to cross. Philosophers in this second group declared themselves skeptics, nihilists, tyrants, or subjectivists, positions that Dewey believes to be far less comfortable in practice than in the safety of a classroom or the solitude of a reflective moment. Not surprisingly, Dewey pursues neither of these strategies. Instead, he declares the supposed split between fact and value to be abstract and artificial, like other philosophical dualisms such as experience and nature, mind and body, thought and action, child and curriculum, individual and society. Dewey says philosophies that separate fact and value are terrible theories with terrible consequences. They allow values to become the subject of unintelligent and undemocratic social procedures.
If intelligent method is lacking, prejudice, the pressure of immediate circumstance, self-interest and class interest, traditional customs, institutions of accidental historic origin are not lacking, and they tend to take the place of intelligence. Thus, we are led to our main proposition. Judgments about values are judgments about the conditions and the results of experienced objects. Judgments about that which should regulate the formation of our desires, affections, and enjoyments.
Dewey's point here is straightforward. Values are certain kinds of experienced facts. This shifts the problem. We no longer try to put fact and value back together again. Instead, we analyze the nature of values and actual experience, or, as Dewey sometimes calls them for emphasis, value facts. Dewey's theory of ethics is experiential or naturalistic. An organism values things in response to its environment. We like or dislike something in our environment. We're satisfied or unsatisfied. Attracted or repelled, we seek or avoid, and we enjoy or suffer. Without conscious life and its reflective strivings, values don't exist. Living beings don't simply passively discover values, they create and recreate them. Values aren't revealed so much as made. This experiential account of values is a hallmark of pragmatic philosophy. In his work, The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life, William James vividly captures this.
Imagine an absolutely material world, containing only physical and chemical facts. Surely there is no status for good and evil to exist in a purely insentient or unconscious world. How can one physical fact, considered simply as physical fact, be better than another? Betterness is not a physical relation. Goodness, badness, and obligation must be realized somewhere in order really to exist. And the first step in ethical philosophy is to see that no mere inorganic nature of things can realize them. Neither moral relations nor the moral law can swing in vacuo. On the whole, then, we must conclude that no philosophy of ethics is possible in the old-fashioned, absolute sense of the term. Everywhere the ethical philosopher must wait on the facts. Ethical treatises may be voluminous and luminous as well, but they never can be final.
James says that values are relations, what James calls moral relations. This revolutionary idea suggests a kind of relativity theory in ethics, a perspective obscured easily by language. When we say a thing is good, goodness appears to be a property of that thing. But Dewey embraces James's argument that nothing is good or bad in a vacuum. To say that something is good, we mean it's good relative to other things, for some organism in some environment. The goodness of the thing or act is simply its experienced relation in a particular situation to the particular desires of a particular person. Dewey develops a second Jamesian insight by pointing out that the things we desire become values only when we experimentally evaluate them. Earlier theories of valuation say that any desired object is valuable, but Dewey disagrees. Valuable objects must have undergone this process of inquiry. According to Dewey, to say that some thing or action is good is to say that inquiry has established its existential relations.
Consider the difference between the proposition, that thing has been eaten, and the judgment, that thing is edible. The former statement involves no knowledge of any relation except the one stated. While we are able to judge of the edibility of anything only when we have a knowledge of its interactions with other things, sufficient to enable us to foresee its probable effects when it is taken into the organism and produces effects there. The more connections and interactions we ascertain, the more we know the object in question. Thinking is search for these connections.
Inquiry transforms enjoyments into values. Thus, the pragmatic worth of inquiry is beyond calculation. Dewey thinks it's ironic that we fail to formulate a theory of values based on inquiry.
The time will come when it will be found passing strange that we of this age should take such pains to control, by every means at command, the formation of ideas of physical things, even those most remote from human concern, and yet are content with haphazard beliefs about the qualities of objects that regulate our deepest interests. There is, by implication, if not explicitly, a prevalent notion that values are already well known, and that all which is lacking is the will to cultivate them in the order of their worth. In fact, the most profound lack is not the will to act upon goods known, but the will to know what they are.
Dewey spells out the conditions that our valuings must fulfill if they're to be rational or intelligent. But Dewey's theory of valuation is different from a theory of values. It doesn't provide us with a list of specific values, a general theory about how to live, or any specific theory about, for instance, telling the truth. Like James, Dewey thinks a general abstract theory of values is impossible. Instead, any such theory must result from inquiry into a particular concrete situation. In ethics, as in natural science, the consequences of experimental method can't be determined before we actually use that method. For Dewey, there are two types of valuing activities and value judgments, prizing and appraising. Something that's prized satisfies a desire. For example, canoeing through superior national forests satisfies a desire for solitude. But prizing something also involves energy and action.
The mother who professes to prize her child and to enjoy the child's companionship, but who systematically neglects the child and does not seek out occasions for being with the child, is deceiving herself.
To appraise something determines how means relate to ends. An appraisal refers to the future. An end may be judged economical or extravagant, realistic or utopian, lasting or fleeting. Prizings rationally evaluate whether a prized object satisfies our desire. Appraisings determine whether some means will yield prized ends. At first, it may seem that prizing is concerned only with ends, and appraising deals only with means. But Dewey denies this. In fact, he denies the traditional separation of ends and means altogether. ends and means are not different kinds of values. They differ only in their timing. What's now a means to an end was itself an end. What's now an end will become, in turn, a means to a new end. So Dewey abandons the term end, replacing it with the term end in view in the phrase continuum of ends means. Dewey says two important consequences follow from this thinking about the relationship of means to ends. First, when we discuss the value of an end, we have to consider the means required to obtain it. Nothing is intrinsically or self-evidently good. Second, we must evaluate any end also as means to further ends. Nothing is a final good. Nothing is a complete good. Only through inquiry can we avoid foolish and short-sighted action. From the perspective of Dewey's theory, we can resolve three central questions in ethics. Are values subjective? Are they relative? And does the end justify the means? First, are values subjective? Dewey answers with a resounding no. A proposition about values describes how an organism relates to its environment, and such a relationship can be objectively evaluated. In this vein, Dewey notes that propositions about potatoes are not starch-filled propositions, just as propositions about human subjects are not subjective. Values themselves are not subjective. They're experienced, transactional relations between organism and environment. The goodness of water for a thirsty man is neither a bare fact about the water or the man. It's a fact about an experienced relation that must include both organism and environment, subject and object. Second, are values relative? Some ethical relativists believe values are relative to individuals. They think what someone believes is valuable to him. But Dewey says this view's silly because values depend not simply upon what someone thinks, but upon his character and his situation. For example, someone may believe, perhaps passionately and totally, that eating sand will satisfy a great hunger. But this doesn't make sand tasty or nutritious. Prejudices, unsupported by experience, may be embraced as truths by those who choose to do so. History provides serious examples of deeply held prejudices that involve race, gender, religion, ethnicity, nationality, and physical abilities. According to Dewey, values are relative to people and situations, not to beliefs. Different organisms or environments produce different values. A good meal, for example, means one thing to a newborn infant and something very different to an Olympic athlete in training. This form of ethical relativism goes hand in hand with Dewey's commitments to individualism and growth. But it's at odds with all armchair ethics. It means we can't rely on blanket principles formulated once and for all in leading our lives. It means we have to continually inquire and act in order to know enough about ourselves and our environment. Without this knowledge, we can't have appropriate desires and we can't efficiently satisfy them.
Morals is connected with actualities of existence, not with ideals, ends, and obligations independent of concrete actualities. The facts upon which it depends are those which arise out of active connections of human beings with one another. The consequences of their mutually intertwined activities in the life of desire, belief, judgment, satisfaction, and dissatisfaction. Ideal morals begin with the perception of these differences.
This is the end of Side One. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.
Dewey's relativism sheds light on a third traditional issue. Does an end justify the means? Here Dewey recalls Charles Lamb's essay on the origin of roast pork. In this story, a house full of pigs burns down. While recovering the remains, the owners burn their fingers and put them in their mouths to cool them. Enjoying the taste and wanting more, they set about building houses, shutting up pigs in them, and burning them down. Dewey says this is absurd only when we appraise the prized end of tasty food in terms of means employed.
The first time roast pork was enjoyed, it was not an end value, since by description it was not the result of desire, foresight, and intent. Upon subsequent occasions, it was, by description, the outcome of prior foresight, desire, and effort, and hence occupy the position of an end in view. There are occasions in which previous effort enhances enjoyment of what is attained, but there are also many occasions in which persons find that when they have attained something as an end, they have paid too high a price in effort and in sacrifice of other ends. Applied in this case, it would mean that the value of the attained end, the eating of roast pork, was such as to warrant the price paid in the means by which it was attained, destruction of dwelling houses and sacrifice of the values to which they contribute.
To separate the value of an end from the value of the means, Dewey notes, is a fallacy. This fallacy is everywhere evident in our society.
Upon the whole, economics has been treated as on a lower level than either morals or politics. Yet the life which men, women, and children actually lead, the opportunities open to them, the values they are capable of enjoying, their education, their share in all the things of art and science, are mainly determined by economic conditions. Hence, we can hardly expect a moral system which ignores economic conditions to be other than remote and empty. Industrial life is correspondingly brutalized by failure to equate it as the means by which social and cultural values are realized. That the economic life, thus exiled from the pale of higher values, takes revenge by declaring that it is the only social reality, denies to deliberate morals and politics any share of causal regulation, is not surprising.
Dewey says social life can be ruled by economic determinism or by experimental inquiry into social and moral values. He created a theory of valuation through experiment, but it still awaits wide-scale adoption in practice.
The practical problem that has to be faced is the establishment of cultural conditions that will support the kinds of behavior in which emotions and ideas, desires and appraisals are integrated.
We've noted that Dewey seeks to reclaim from supposedly empirical philosophers an account of experience, a theory of inquiry from so-called logicians, and a philosophy of education from would-be educators. He wants to reclaim a liberal social theory from earlier liberals and a theory of valuation from moral authorities. Similarly, he seeks to reclaim from organized religion the true religious dimension of life.
Religion has lost itself in cults, dogmas, and myths. Consequently, the office of religion as sense of community and one's place in it has been lost. In effect, religion has been distorted into a possession or burden of a limited part of human nature, of a limited portion of humanity which finds no way to universalize religion, except by imposing its own dogmas and ceremonies upon others, of a limited class within a partial group, priests, saints, a church. Thus, other gods have been set up before the one God. Religion, as a sense of the whole, is the most individualized of all things, the most spontaneous, undefinable, and varied. For individuality signifies unique connections in the whole, within the flickering, inconsequential acts of separate selves, dwells a sense of the whole, which claims and dignifies them.
Dewey developed harsh, penetrating criticisms of religious practices and beliefs in the supernatural. He wants to reconstruct, deepen, expand religious experience, not, as many of his critics have supposed, to eliminate or ridicule it. Dewey's religious views are most thoroughly and accessibly developed in his brief book, A Common Faith. In an effort to separate religious experience from supernatural beliefs and practices, he begins by distinguishing a religion and the religious. A religion is an institutionalized set of particular beliefs and practices. Dewey emphasizes that all experience may have a religious quality.
The actual religious quality in the experience described is the effect produced, the better adjustment in life and its conditions. If the reorientation actually occurs, it and the sense of security and stability accompanying it are forces on their own account. It takes place in different persons in a multitude of ways. It is sometimes brought about by devotion to a cause, sometimes by a passage of poetry that opens a new perspective. Sometimes, as was the case with Spinoza, deemed an atheist in his day, through philosophical reflection.
Dewey emphasizes that the religious attitude directs action towards a proposed ideal, but he says religious values are ideals, and this fact has been ignored or denied in the quests for certainty by traditional thinkers of every sort. They believe that what they ardently want to be so already is so.
Starting, say, from such an idea as that justice is more than a moral ideal, because it is embedded in the very makeup of the actually existent world, men have gone on to build up vast intellectual schemes, philosophies, and theologies to prove that ideals are real, not as ideals, but as antecedently existing actualities. They have failed to see that in converting moral realities into matters of intellectual assent, they have evinced lack of moral faith. Faith that something should be in existence as far as lies in our power is changed into the intellectual belief that it is already in existence. When physical existence does not bear out the assertion, the physical is subtly changed into the metaphysical. In this way, moral faith has been inextricably tied up with intellectual beliefs about the supernatural.
Dewey quickly adds that not all moral faith in ideal ends is necessarily religious in quality. Moral faith that will stick to a diet, for example, is not a religious attitude, no matter how intensely it's pursued. Religious experience emerges only when ideals unify the self. Dewey explains that these unifying ideals must be inclusive and general.
Any activity pursued in behalf of an ideal end, against obstacles and in spite of threats of personal loss, because of conviction of its general and enduring value, is religious in quality. Many a person, inquirer, artist, philanthropist, citizen men and women in the humblest walks of life, have achieved, without presumption and without display, such unification of themselves and of their relations to conditions of existence. It remains to extend their spirit and inspiration to ever wider numbers. If I have said anything about religions and religion that seems harsh, I have said those things because of a firm belief that the claim on the part of religion to possess a monopoly of ideals and of the supernatural means by which alone, it is alleged, they can be furthered stands in the way of the realization of distinctively religious values inherent in natural experience. Just because the release of these values is so important, their identification with the creeds and cults of religions must be dissolved.
Dewey believes this more general concept of religion will be increasingly accepted because there's been a revolution in the seat of intellectual authority, to use a phrase coined by William James that Dewey often repeated. Experimental inquiry now is the final arbiter of all questions on the nature of reality. This revolution in intellectual authority is centered not in results, but method of inquiry. A public, cooperative, observational, experimental, controlled, self-correcting method. Dewey argues that all belief in the supernatural now is intellectually indefensible and unwarranted. Whether Catholic or Muslim, Protestant or Buddhist, rationalist or mystic, liberationist or fundamentalist. Not surprisingly, Dewey's view has called forth impassioned disagreement and strong criticism. In a book of essays on Dewey that includes Dewey's long reply, American philosopher Edward Schaub disagrees and responds to him.
Man's sense of dependence is indeed more profound than anything derivable from the experience of those precarious elements of the environment, which Dewey stresses, or from the realization by an individual that his successes are conditioned by cooperating factors of his physical and social world. But through other channels also, man comes to experience what has aptly been called a creature felling, and is claimed quite properly to derive from man's consciousness, however aroused of the roots and of the limitations of his being. Here, then, he encounters reality in the sense both of antecedent and of ultimate, and here, as the weight of the evidence would seem to prove, is the basis of an experience which may be distinguished as religious. Emphasis upon work and upon wonder in connection therewith is ever a needed gospel, and Dewey's message is perhaps peculiarly suited to the needs of our day. Yet what is also required, and probably even more deeply, is a corresponding stress upon the indispensability of worship, and of that particular exercise of wonder to which worship gives rise and by which it is refined.
Dewey responds on two fronts. First, he argues that it's simply narrow-minded to limit religious experience to some supernatural object of worship. Second, he says inquiry shows religious beliefs to be false, no matter how psychologically comforting they may be. Even mystical flashes or born-again experiences provide no evidence for belief in the supernatural.
The idea that by its very nature, the mystical experience is a vertical realization of the direct presence of God does not rest so much upon examination of the facts as it does upon importing into their interpretation a conception that is formed outside them. In its dependence upon a prior conception of the supernatural, which is the thing to be proved, it begs the question. As with every empirical phenomenon, the occurrence of the state called mystical is simply an occasion for inquiry into its mode of causation. There is no more reason for converting the experience itself into an immediate knowledge of its cause than in the case of an experience of lightning or any other natural occurrence.
There's an important lesson in Dewey's rejection of religious dogmas and rationalizations. He wants to free religious experience from any particular belief so that inquiry will no longer threaten its reality. This strategy allows Dewey to offer a natural rather than supernatural account of God. He describes God as an ideal rather than a real being. He defines God in terms of ideal ends unified through the imagination. This isn't to suggest that this unity is a fantasy or doubtfully real. All ideals are grasped through the imagination. The unity of these ideals doesn't mean they constitute a single being or entity. Rather, it means that our deepest commitments, when they exist, form a unified whole that holds us and directs our actions. It supplies a central unity to our lives. To characterize God as real rather than ideal, as an independent existence, an external power, is to surrender the demand for our own actions and responsibility. Separating God from human ideals and human actions substitutes an unwarranted optimism or pessimism for a much-needed meliorism. It diminishes the faith that the future may be improved through human action. Dewey observes,
belief in the supernatural as a necessary power for apprehension of the ideal and for practical attachment to it has, for its counterpart, a pessimistic belief in the corruption and impotency of natural means. This is axiomatic in Christian dogma. But this apparent pessimism has a way of suddenly changing into an exaggerated optimism. For according to the terms of the doctrine, if the faith in the supernatural is of the required order, regeneration at once takes place. Goodness in all essentials is thereby established. If not, there is proof that the established relation to the supernatural has been vitiated. This romantic optimism is one cause for the excessive attention to individual salvation, characteristic of traditional Christianity. Belief in a sudden and complete transmutation through conversion and in the objective efficacy of prayer is too easy a way out of difficulties. The position of natural intelligence is that there exists a mixture of good and evil, and that reconstruction in the direction of the good, which is indicated by ideal ends, must take place, if at all, through continued cooperative effort.
Dewey says there's an urgent need for intelligent effort to unify our ideal ends. Too often, human goals and ideals are unfocused or superficial. Human action on behalf of these ideals is unshared, sporadic, short-term. Dewey says religions are committed to the supernatural, so they can't meet these needs in an intelligent way. But what Dewey calls militant atheism also isn't a solution. It views the world as indifferent and hostile, picturing man as solitary and defiant or despairing. Dewey says it ignores the reality of ideals and their connection with human experience. It ignores the irreducibly social character of the individual self. A genuinely religious attitude must begin with an individual's connections to a natural and social world.
Religion would then be found to have its natural place in every aspect of human experience that is concerned with estimate of possibilities, with emotional stir by possibilities as yet unrealized, and with all action in behalf of their realization. All that is significant in human experience falls within this frame.
From an intellectual standpoint, Dewey argues that religions and supernaturalism have been unseated by inquiry and naturalism. But this decline in the intellectual authority of religions is small compared to their decline in social authority. Dewey argues that religions control forms of human association. To some extent, it too must be recovered. Dewey observes that rites, subclasses of religion used to pervade society. Communities were based onto it and were educated by its customs and legends. But this change in history.
The intellectual conflict of and theological beliefs has attracted much more attention. It is still near the focus of attention. But the change in the social center of gravity of religion has gone on so steadily and is now so generally accomplished for thought of most persons. The thing of is that the church is a special institution within and may be unmade by the state. Not only the national state, but other forms of organization among groups have grown in power and influence at the expense of organizations built upon and about a religion. These social modes have grown so much that they exercise the greater hold upon the person, even the church.
So suffers from a split between theory and practice.
The fundamentalist in religion is one whose beliefs in intellectual content have hardly been touched by scientific developments. His heaven and changes that have followed from applications of science. At the same time, the notion that basic and ultimate spiritual and ideal values are associated with the supernatural has persisted as a kind of vague background and aura. A kind of polite deference to the notion remains, along with a concrete transfer of interest. The general mind is thus left in
saved by external, independent, supernatural sources. Later, in a second stage of growth, the natural and the supernatural are held to be complementary. The fully naturalistic view would represent a third stage of growth. Here, the values of religions are seen to be ideals based on the features of nature and natural associations. These natural features are projected into the supernatural realm for the sake of certainty and security. Dewey stresses that this third stage of growth has not been widely attained. His view was and still is untried and untested. He believed it to be a problem that demands our collective actions, a prospective truth that awaits consequences. Here he echoes William James's pragmatic emphasis on action.
If we are empiricists, if we believe that no bell in us tolls to let us know for certain when truth is in our grasp, then it ceases to count our life in our hands.
Dewey recognizes that powerful vested interests want to prevent intelligent religious inquiry. At one time, entrenched interests had simply opposed intelligent inquiry into physical nature.
They insisted, for example, that demons rather than diseases cause death. Dewey says that rejecting inquiry and its results is as chilling now as it was then.
Natural relations of husband and wife, of parent and child, friend and friend, neighbor and neighbor, of fellow workers in industry, science, and art, are neglected, passed over, not developed for all that is in them. The objection to supernaturalism is that it stands in the way of an effective realization of the sweep and depth of the implications of natural human relations. It stands in the way of using the means that are in our power to make radical changes in these relations. It is certainly true that great material changes might be made with no corresponding improvement of a spiritual or ideal nature. But development in the latter direction cannot be introduced from without. It cannot be brought about by dressing up material and economic changes with decorations derived from the supernatural. It can come only from more intense realization of values that inhere in the actual connections of human beings with one another.
The nature of religion is a practical question that confronts us all.
Those who face the alternatives will also have to ask whether what they accomplish when they point with one hand to the seriousness of present evils is not undone when the other hand points away from man and nature for their remedy.
Here Dewey approaches the view of another American philosopher, Josiah Royce. Royce proclaimed that our salvation lies in community, a community that extends into the past and future. Dewey stresses at the close of A Common Faith that salvation isn't a matter of predetermined grace, revelation, or good luck. It's a matter of continuing common action.
Ours is the responsibility of conserving, transmitting, rectifying, and expanding the heritage of values we have received, that those who come after us may receive it more solid and secure, more widely accessible, and more generously shared than we have received it. Here are all the elements for a religious faith that shall not be confined to sect, class, or race. Such a faith has always been implicitly the common faith of mankind. It remains to make it explicit and militant.
Just as Dewey sought to recover religious experience from religion, so too he seeks to recover aesthetic experience from art museums and art theorists. His fullest statement on aesthetic experience in art is contained in his book, Art and Experience, based on his 1932 talks at Harvard as the first William James lecturer. This book contains some of Dewey's most moving and lively writing. It brings together many of the major elements of his theory of experience. It clarifies how extensively his work in logic, education, politics, ethics, and religion draws on his account of experience. In addition, it answers critics, skeptics, and other traditional thinkers who suppose that the pragmatic Dewey stresses merely intermediate values at the expense of final values.
In short, the history of human experience is a history of the development of arts. There are substantially but two alternatives. Either art is a continuation by means of intelligent selection and arrangement of natural tendencies of natural events, or art is a peculiar addition to nature, springing from something dwelling exclusively within the breast of man, whatever name be given the latter.
Before undercutting the tired old intellectual disputes about the nature of art and aesthetic experience, Dewey begins by noting a social fact. Art is separated from everyday common life experiences. The separation's partly spatial. Art, or at least great art, is enclosed in museums and other special artificial places. More importantly, it's also separated from us and our experience.
When artistic objects are separated from both conditions of origin and operation in experience, a wall is built around them that renders almost opaque their general significance. A primary task is thus to restore continuity between the refined and intensified forms of experience that are works of art and the everyday events, doing, and sufferings that are universally recognized to constitute experience.
If we separate art from culture, we don't see that everyday events have aesthetic quality. Dewey says the grace of the ballplayer, the delight of the gardener, the zest of the camper poking a fire, all exhibit aesthetic quality. We don't see that our everyday creations and recreations can also be art. These arts might include television dramas, newspaper stories, and comic strips, pop music, skilled work, sports, landscaping and housing, clothing, furniture, much more. As Dewey notes, the costumes and utensils that now fill our museums and art history books were once everyday elements in the significant life of a society. Torn away from its place in direct experience, art can't retain its significant character. Aesthetic theories isolate art from actual social life, yet the theories themselves don't arise in a social vacuum. Instead, they reflect the physical and imaginary separation of art from human life.
Most European museums are, among other things, memorials of the rise of nationalism and imperialism. The growth of capitalism has been a powerful influence in the development of the museum as the proper home for works of art, and in the promotion of the idea that they are apart from the common life. The nouveau riche, who are an important byproduct of the capitalist system, have felt especially bound to surround themselves with works of fine art which, being rare, are also costly. Generally speaking, the typical collector is the typical capitalist. For evidence of good standing in the realm of higher culture, he amasses paintings, statuary, and artistic bijoux as his stocks and bonds certify to his standing in the economic world. Not merely individuals, but communities and nations put their cultural good taste in evidence by building opera houses, galleries, and museums. These show that a community is not wholly absorbed in material wealth because it is willing to spend its gains in patronage of art. These things reflect and establish superior cultural status, while their segregation from the common life reflects the fact that they are not part of a native and spontaneous culture.
Dewey's strategy for reuniting art and life begins with ordinary experience. Ordinary experience is subjective and objective, an affair of organism and environment. Dewey says whenever an organism imposes form, order, or coherence on its changing environment, the resulting experience has an aesthetic dimension. Dewey calls it art in germ. Not all experiences contain this formal structure, stability, qualitative unity. They lack an aesthetic dimension. Dewey says that often, maybe almost always, our experience lacks unity. Sometimes we drift only for the present, without pattern or structure. If we're fortunate, we may stumble on enjoyments for a while, but we realize no genuine final values. At other times, we operate mechanically and live for the future. We study to get a grade, to pass a course, to complete a major, to earn a degree, to get a job, to get a better job, to retire wealthy, to die. If we're fortunate, we may stumble upon success, but we usually experience little immediate intrinsic value. At other times, our experience may unify means and end, effort and achievement, beginning and conclusion, desire and satisfaction. Dewey writes that this sort of unified experience is a completion.
We have an experience when the material experienced runs its course to fulfillment. Then and only then is it integrated within and demarcated in the general stream of experience from other experiences. A piece of work is finished in a way, playing a game of chess, carrying on a conversation, writing a book, or taking part in a political campaign, is so rounded out that its close is a consummation and not a cessation.
Unified experiences are qualitatively unique. A particular individual quality pervades them. Dewey says this quality gives an experience its identity and name. That conversation in the bar, that argument, or that family vacation trip. Whenever experience has this qualitative unity, Dewey says it has aesthetic quality. These experiences differ from the distinctively aesthetic experience, that is, from art, only as a matter of degree. Art manifests in its form the same unity of doing and undergoing, of making and appreciating that characterizes any unified experience. So the distinctively aesthetic or artistic experience involves doing, making, transforming. It involves what Dewey calls the producer's standpoint, singing, playing, molding, carving, so on. Artistic experience also involves undergoing, perceiving, enjoying. Dewey calls this the consumer's standpoint as we listen, taste, love, appreciate, so on. The goal of many activities is something distinct from this unity of experience. Such a goal controls the experience, and it's complete only when it's over. But in distinctively aesthetic or artistic experience, the goal unifies the experience at each and every moment. Dewey says the form of the whole is present in each part. The significance of a novel or painting, for example, is not realized only in the final sentence or last brushstroke. This insight makes possible a new understanding of distinctively aesthetic experiences or objects.
In a distinctively aesthetic experience, characteristics that are subdued in other experiences are dominant. Those that are subordinate are controlling. Because of elimination of all that does not contribute to mutual organization of the factors of both action and reception into one another, and because of selection of just the aspects and traits that contribute to their interpretation of each other, the product is a work of aesthetic art. Man whistles, carves, sings, dances, gestures, molds, draws, and paints. The doing and making is artistic when the perceived result is of such a nature that its qualities as perceived have controlled the question of production. An object is peculiarly and dominantly aesthetic, yielding the enjoyment characteristic of aesthetic perception, when the factors that determine anything which can be called an experience are lifted high above the threshold of perception and are made manifest for their own sake.
According to Dewey, expression requires that we reflect on our emotions, clarify their meanings in order and transform them in action. We must control a particular medium for expression. But when this control is undeveloped, self-expression is tragically impossible.
What is kindled must either burn itself out, turning to ashes, or must press itself out in material that changes the latter from crude metal into a refined product. Many a person is unhappy, tortured within, because he has at command no art of expressive action. What under happier conditions might be used to convert objective material into material of an intense and clear experience seethes within in unruly turmoil, which finally dies down after perhaps a painful inner disruption. What most of us lack in order to be artists is not the inceptive emotion, nor yet merely technical skill in execution. It is capacity to work a vague idea and emotion over into terms of some definite medium.
When we actively control a medium, emotions transformed into expression. Art is nature that's been heightened, intensified, and transformed. Science also transforms nature, but in a different way. Science focuses on the general relations among experiences, and it states meanings. Art focuses on the particular qualitative immediacy of an experience, and it expresses meanings. According to Dewey, science leads to experiences, art constitutes experiences. Expressive objects of art cut through familiarity, prejudice, customs, routine, closed habits, and indifference.
The arts accomplish this result not by self-conscious intention, but in the very operation of creating, by means of new objects, new modes of experience. Every art communicates because it expresses. it enables us to share vividly and deeply in meanings to which we had been dumb. Art breaks through barriers that divide human beings, which are impermeable in ordinary association.
Many theories of art begin by separating the subject and object of aesthetic experience, but Dewey says these aspects in actual experience are indivisible. He suggests art is not a function of object or subject in isolation from one another. Instead, art's a matter of experience, a matter of both subject and object. Dewey summarizes his lengthy criticisms of earlier theorists.
The uniquely distinguishing feature of aesthetic experience is exactly the fact that no such distinction of self and object exists in it. Since it is aesthetic in the degree in which organism and environment cooperate to institute an experience in which the two are so fully integrated that each disappears.
Dewey claims that art's a manifestation, a record, a celebration of human civilization. The moral function of art is to promote growth, harmony, and community.
Human relations, institutions, and traditions are as much a part of nature as the physical world. Nature, in this meaning, is not outside. It is in us, and we are in and of it. Works of art are means by which we enter, through imagination and the emotions they evoke, into other forms of relationship and participation than our own.
Accordingly, Dewey calls art an incomparable organ of instruction, an organ that suggests unrealized possibilities for human life.
The creators of such works of art are entitled, when successful, to the gratitude that we give to inventors of microscopes and microphones. In the end, they open new objects to be observed and enjoyed. This is a genuine service, but only an age of combined confusion and conceit will arrogate to works that perform this special utility the exclusive name of fine art. Experience in the form of art, when reflected upon, we conclude by saying, solves more problems which have troubled philosophers and resolves more hard and fast dualisms than any other theme of thought.
Seen in this light, a culture's philosophy can become both thoroughly aesthetic and thoroughly pragmatic. Philosophy can become both intrinsically and instrumentally valuable. Dewey sought to realize this possibility for philosophy and culture, and his commitment to this goal never wavered. His revolutionary work in logic, education, politics, ethics, religion, and aesthetics embodies and serves this vision of philosophy in human life. It also influenced the way many modern thinkers approach their work. Dewey's pragmatism locates our philosophy in our actions, in our lives. Philosophy is not what we nod to, think while listening safely to a tape, or say while sitting in the isolation of a classroom. Dewey says we have to commit ourselves to experience, inquiry, growth, individualism, community, freedom, religious attitude, and aesthetic experience. We must put our commitments into practice if they're to be genuine commitments. Dewey's far-reaching writings may point the way, but his vision demands individual action that lies in the future for each one of us. This is the fundamental challenge of Dewey's philosophy. When this tape has finished, his challenge will still remain.
All peoples at all times have been narrowly realistic in practice and have then employed idealization to cover up in sentiment and theory their brutalities. But never, perhaps, has the tendency been so dangerous and so tempting as with ourselves. Faith in the power of intelligence to imagine a future which is the projection of the desirable in the present and to invent the instrumentalities of its realization is our salvation. And it is a faith which must be nurtured and made articulate. Surely, a sufficiently large task for our philosophy.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of John Dewey by Knowledge Products.